Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Carrie L., and this is Carrie L.'s HeartLink Show. And as I connect to as many hearts as possible, we are creating more freedom and light, one interview at a time. My programs will bring you insights into the Great Awakening that is underway on planet Earth as we approach 2012. And I'll be keeping you abreast of the latest tools available for anchoring a greater and healthier reality into your life. I'll be interviewing cutting-edge experts in the metaphysical, scientific, paranormal, and spiritual. Stay tuned for the next hour as I speak with one of the most recognizable names in ufology, Stan Friedman. I'm looking forward to this, and we'll go to him in a moment. And at the bottom of the hour, at 4:30, you can call in with your questions. So look on the internet, and you will see the 800 numbers that are available. And I'm assuming that you're on the internet. And for now, let's just take a deep breath and allow the sacred love to flow through you now. And relax. And good things are coming your way. The blessing of the day is from the Gayatri Prayer. Let us focus on that effulgent light from which the whole universe is projected. May this inner sun enlighten our minds and hearts, and may we awaken as that light. All right, I am going to suggest that you also go to my website at heartlinkinstitute.com, where you'll find a lot of wonderful things happening, and we'll have events, classes. Tonight, in fact, we're having a wonderful class in the Kundalini. I teach esoteric sciences as well as transpersonal psychology, and I am a therapist, and have been for over 25 years. So I am helping the planet, I hope, with as much information that I can share with you. And there are plenty of Ascension articles on my website, as well as the Zeitgeist movie from this last year that is so phenomenal that people are raving about. You'll see the link to that, as well as a photos on UFOs and so forth. So do check over the whole website, heartlinkinstitute.com, as well as check on my crop circle cards, which I highly recommend if you're wanting to plug into your highest consciousness. All right, we are going now to our special guest, and I've been looking forward to this. I have seen Stan many times. Stan Friedman, who, like I say, is probably one of the originals from way back in the 60s. You have written a book, Stan, and we'll talk about that today, which is titled Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. So I'm really looking forward to that. And Stan Friedman has received Bachelor of Science and Master's of Science degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 1956. He was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as GE, GM, Westinghouse, McDonnell Douglas, and so forth. And since the mid-60s, he's lectured on topics, flying saucers are real, at more than 600 colleges and over 100 professional groups. So you've been around, Stan.
I'm just an old guy having fun. Yeah, I've been around. Oh. 16 other countries, all 50 states, 9 provinces, hundreds of radio and television shows. One advantage of all that is you get a feedback loop. You find out what people care about. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a brand new book, Flying Saucers and Science, and one of the reasons for doing it is that I figure I've answered 45,000 questions over the years after lectures and in classrooms. I mean, it's the same questions generally over and over again, but still, you get a much better handle that way on what people care about. What do they know? What are they not aware of that they should be? And what bugs them? You know. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you know, over the years, you've witnessed changes for sure. And by the way, welcome to the show. And why don't you share, are there things that stand out more than others over the years that people have been interested in?
Well, one of the things that surprises many people when they ask me about it is people ask, you know, is there more interest now than there was when you got started and stuff like that. And what I have found is there's been a consistency. I remember in 1968 at a talk at East Carolina State University in Greenville, North Carolina. We had 2,000 people there. And it was I was one of a series of speakers they had over the course of the academic year. Mm-hmm. Mine had the biggest attendance of any of them. So people are interested. Now, Greenville's a small town, and at that time there wasn't much to do, and you only had 3 television stations, you know, the networks. And there were no problem, no good side or bad side of the internet or the video rentals or anything like that. So there wasn't much to do, but still, the interest has always been there. The problem has always been that people are fearful of ridicule. Mm-hmm. That is to say, will they show up for a talk? Well, it depends. If you're sponsoring a professional scientist like me at a college, then if I turn out to be a nut, at least you can't blame the people for coming, you know, legitimate circumstances. And what I found is that people can handle the tough message. I come on very strong in my lectures, and I often get people saying, well, you must get a hard time from everybody. I start every lecture saying, now it's after 50 years of study and investigation, 4 major conclusions. 1, the evidence is overwhelming. Planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. In other words, some UFOs are alien spacecraft. Couldn't put it any more baldly than that. The second conclusion is that we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate. That means some few people within major governments have known since at least July 1947, Roswell time, that indeed the planet is being visited since we recovered wreckage and bodies. 3rd is there are no good arguments against these 2 conclusions. Only people who haven't studied the evidence, and I take on the noisy negativists as they call them, as I call them, including my University of Chicago classmate for 3 years, Carl Sagan, because their arguments sound great until you look at the evidence, and they collapse. And finally, 4, we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. Visits to planet Earth by alien spacecraft, successful cover-up of the best data, bodies, and wreckage for 60 years now. Now, that's a pretty strong message. Mm-hmm. I've only had 11 hecklers out of more than 700 lectures, and 2 of them were drunk. And you get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics, and as old Harry Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
Well, good for you. Can I interrupt for just a
sure.
second? Because, Seth, I'm going to just interrupt our show and get my picture up there on the website, please. I told him I would be interrupting the show if my picture's not up there, so on Station 1. So hopefully we'll have more people tuning in because we do want to let people know that you are on right now with me, Stan
okay.
Friedman. And, yeah, let's get that information up there on the website at BBS Radio. And I'm so thankful that we do have BBS broadcasting these phenomenal shows that are, like I say, creating more information for people so that they can be more aware of what's really going on behind the scenes. So you've brought the truth to people, and you're saying that people are pretty much open to it, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not a masochist. I nobody's thrown a tomato or you know, anything at me. And I judge by the question and answer period as a good example of people who are curious. And the thing is, because I don't mince words, I also have an unusually good opportunity at the end of my lectures. I ask the first question: how many people here believe they've seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer? And I've defined my terms early on. And I'll make a joke, you know, we didn't let the CIA in, it's okay to admit it, just raise your hand and I'll count. And I start counting and pointing, 1, 2, 3, 4, and at first the people's hands go up very slowly. They know I'm not going to laugh. My lectures, flying saucers, are real. How could I laugh at them? But they're not sure about the rest of the audience. And by the time I get to the other side of the hall, the hands go up much more vigorously. And I'm counting out loud all this time, and typically it's 10%, which is an awful lot of people and comes as a major shock to people. Everybody thinks he's the only one. That's, and, you know.
And, Has it happened that it's increased over the years, more?
Not so much. I don't think so. And the kicker is my next question, which is, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down.
Yeah.
And then I'd try another question. If there's any hands left, I'll say, how many of you were in the military at the time? And then, presuming there are some, you want to tell us about it. And I get great responses to that question. One guy in front of 1,350 people in East Texas State University said, I can't, they told me not to say anything, which was a wonderful line. I had another guy in Indiana say, they took my pictures. And there's dead silence, and we're waiting. And finally I say, look, you know, I'm not asking your name. You don't need to stand up, but I'm sure the audience would like to hear the rest of the story. Everybody claps. So he remained seated and told us about flying an Air Force plane, four-engine plane, over the Pacific. Plane ahead of them 20 miles, radios back. There's a saucer heading your way. They had gun cameras. They took pictures. They contacted the base they were going to, because the film gets handled by intelligence people on the base, not by the crew. And they were all debriefed and told not to say anything. Well, you get enough stories like that all over the country, and I don't use them in my lectures, so they know that I'm not just picking up, you know, I know the people out there aren't echoing what I've said. This is fresh information. So when I ask at my table, I've got several books and papers and all that stuff, and it's a good way to meet people because they want to talk to you, but they want it to be safe. But I'll ask people to tell me their story. Many times I say, I've never told anybody else, but they'll tell me about it, say. And I'll say, why didn't you report it? They think I was some kind of a nut, is the most common answer I get. And so even though the polls have shown that there are more believers than non-believers, people still think that most other people won't accept the story. And I did a very educational thing, just by luck almost, at a college campus in a class with about 100 students. I said, I want to know how you feel on certain in certain areas, but I don't want you to be influenced by the other kids in the class. So I want you to close your eyes and vote with your hand. Your instructor and I will count the votes. And it turned out that about 80% said they thought most people didn't believe in flying saucers. But 80% of that group did believe in flying saucers. Our behavior is apparently determined by our perception of how other people will respond rather than by our own feelings. And so I've tried to understand that in terms of how people will react and to encourage people to speak out. You know, come on in, the water's fine, it's okay. And so I think, my perception is, that people can handle the truth about flying saucers, at least knowing that the planet's being visited and the government's lying through its teeth. I mean, how do you think people reacted to this crazy business down in Stephenville, Texas? I mean, I was on the Larry King show, and talking to some of the people who were down there. And, you know, the Air Force says, we didn't have any planes flying down there. And then 2 weeks later, oh, you know what? We made a mistake. There were 10 F-16s trotting around.
All of a sudden, they throw that in.
Yeah, I mean, where were they all this time? And
well, that kind of backs up one of the observers said that there was one flying after one of the UFOs. So
that's the thing. And the UFO was something huge. And, you know, and it's come out, of course, where this happened is not too far from where President Bush's ranch is. And so maybe those jets were scrambled because the radar picked up an intruder.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to go after it. But in any event, F-16s are noisy, and the first sightings by the guy, the thing was moving maybe 3,000 miles an hour, and there wasn't any sound at all. Now, nobody would ever say an F-16 didn't make any noise, especially when it was flying low. So I think the public...
Are most of them silent, would you say?
One of the most disturbing or interesting characteristics is the relative silence, yes. When I talk to people, I ask them to describe what happened, you know, and we go along quite a ways, and I try to make sure that people don't interpret what they saw. You know, if I ask about size, how big was it compared to the moon? And for the audience, maybe people don't know it, but if you hold an aspirin tablet at arm's length, you can just cover the moon, and many people think it takes a quarter, a dollar, or something. Just an aspirin tablet. So I try to make sure people don't say it was just over the next hill when there's no way to judge that. But
in San Diego, the reports, there were a bunch of people who called into Fox Network and here in Claremont. And in fact, they even videoed it. And this is on New Year's Day. Huh. And why it hasn't gotten more publicity, I don't know. It's on my website. So, again,
well,
heartlinkinstitute.com.
You pointed at one of the crucial things is the press's role. Now, this time with Texas, because the woman, Angela, I can't remember her last name, who worked for the Stephenville paper, wrote a few articles that played it straight. She knew the people. She was getting consistent reports. As soon as she published a decent article, more people came forward. Instead of starting with, you know, silly season is here again in Texas and mm-hmm. people are looking for little guys, little green men or anything like that, she played it straight, as you would a robbery, an automobile accident, something like that. And I think this all began when the Chicago Tribune article on January 1st, 2007, a little over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
a front-page article about sightings over O'Hare Airport, very good case.
Mm-hmm.
What was amazing to many people was that, and especially the Tribune, was that the article got more hits on their website than anything they'd ever published before, over a million hits.
People are hungry for this information.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Newspapers are hurting circulation-wise, as you know, and when they found out, even the Trib commented about it, that they had no idea there was that much interest. And the reporter got calls from all over the world.
I can't imagine that they are that fast asleep.
Well, I
can. You know what I'm saying?
I think it's
selective, obviously, that they're choosing not to know this information.
Well, if you look, Newsweek, 18th of January, had a terrible article by a guy who teaches writing at Yale University, and he only quotes the noisy negativists. And I found his website, and he's got rules for non-plagiarism and for academic honesty and all this stuff on his website, and he violated all the rules in the article. He didn't go for the sources. He didn't dig out people who know anything. He talked to some noisy negativists. I mean, I debated with one of them, Michael Shermer, head of the Skeptics Society, publishes a Skeptics magazine, as a matter of fact, so he's got a vested interest. And I did a three-hour debate with him on George Noory's Coast to Coast Radio. I got 80% of the vote. It was very simple. We'd both been on the Larry King Show on July 13th, and it was there, obvious there he didn't know anything. He was playing with little green dolls, if you will, alien dolls. And he got away with, because the show was much too crowded, with saying things that didn't make any sense. Well, when I got him on...
Agree. It was bizarre.
Yes, it was. Well, when I got
Buzz Aldrin was bizarre.
Well, when I got him on Coast to Coast, he starts off, and he tried this again and got away with it because I wasn't there on a very recent Larry King show. Well, it's just the residue effect. You know, anytime you look over strange stuff, there'll always be some things that you can't explain, and don't worry about it. And, boy, that gave me an excuse. He talked about 5% unexplainable. Well, I blasted him because I pointed out that in Blue Book Special Report 14, 21.5% couldn't be explained, completely separate from the ones for which there was not enough information. They did a cross-comparison. The probability of the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. University of Colorado study, 30% of 117 cases. And I went down three more studies. And, you know, he hadn't done any homework in the almost 3 weeks between the two programs. I had read two of his books and quoted back some of the things he said. And this is a typical attitude of the noisy, negative.
Well, they're not really even caring. And, you know, this is not... They have no investment in any of this at all. They just like to throw a wrench into things. You know, it's obvious. Most people who heard that show, I mean, were just shaking their heads.
I got a lot of email on that one. Several people saying, I don't understand why I didn't just punch him out. I said, it's not my style.
Yeah. Well, and other shows, like the Peter Jennings one, I must say,
I'm
glad at least we had something on national TV, but it was a far cry from fair and even reporting.
It was worse than not fair. It was so heavily biased. I mean, I got a whole review on it on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and the important areas dealing with the question of flying saucers, it's the three things, abductions, Roswell, and interstellar travel. And they really fouled up all of them. I mean, yes, I do resent being called a promoter twice, and them using 20 seconds out of an hour interview and say the witnesses crawled out of the woodwork and there wasn't any evidence for Roswell, when in fact I was spending hundreds of dollars a month for years trying to find witnesses. It wasn't easy in the pre-internet days. And where there was loads of evidence, and these guys are still pulling out the crazy notion, and the head of the Skeptic Society did this on George Norrie back a couple of weeks ago. Well, people need to go to the original articles, he said, and all that happened was this rancher comes in with some paper and balsa wood and strips and stuff, and... You know, you go to the original articles. That's all there was. Well, that was an article on July 9th. It doesn't say anything about the July 8th articles, which got involved with Major Marcel and his son. Well, his son came into the picture later that we found out about it. But all kinds of efforts made. I mean, here we got the most elite military group in the whole world. They dropped the atom bombs on Japan, two of them, and then two more in tests in the Pacific. And that doesn't get mentioned. Mm-hmm. Jesse Marcel, Jr. was interviewed on the Jennings show. They didn't bother to mention that he was a medical doctor, a flight surgeon, a helicopter pilot, was actively serving in Iraq, having been called back in at age 67, mind you, and had served on military aircraft accident investigative teams and flew 225 combat hours over there. None of that got mentioned.
Well, you mentioned that the Roswell story is a cosmic Watergate. I love that. I'm interested, and do you feel that there was the some kind of weapon used to shoot down that Roswell UFO?
No, I don't, actually. I see no reason to say that there was. I think they ran it. Well, let me put that. There's a possibility on another level. We know that there was a radar system on, just heading north over at White Sands, and that it was not circling around. They were going to be launching a V-2 rocket the next morning, and because this was all vacuum stuff, maybe your listeners don't remember when people used vacuum tubes instead of transistors and microcircuits, but you left equipment on so it would all be warmed up. And so it was one of the few places in the world where if you were tootling along in a saucer, you might run through this beam much to your surprise, and it might have affected a guidance system or propulsion system, you know, instantaneous. There were probably two of them. A big percentage of the sightings that summer were more than one object at a time. So maybe a temporary glitch, and suddenly you get a mid-air collision. One explodes over the Brazos Ranch. The other one goes down in the plains of San Agustin. And I talked to a retired Air Force general who had actually been base commander at Wright-Patterson, General Exxon. And he had been a pilot, and as a matter of fact, during World War II. He was a prisoner of war, got shot down one time. And I said, when you have a mid-air collision, is the damage usually pretty much the same to the two planes? And he said, no. Usually one manages to get back in. It's damaged, but you still have control. Mm-hmm. And the other one loses a wing or an engine or something, and it's tough out of luck. That sounds what happened here. So, you know, I wouldn't call that a weapon. And the thing is that if you look at the stories of the people who were directly involved in the Air Force, lied in their two fat reports. And one, they said, oh, they talked to everybody who was firsthand knowledge. That's a lie. Flat out lie. They said that they started the story by saying that the story first appeared in the National Enquirer in 1978 when Major Marcel claimed that he had recovered a flying saucer. Also in 1978, a UFO researcher, Stanton Friedman, met with Marcel and started looking for other witnesses. Well, the article appeared in 1980, and I'd already found, with Bill Moore, we had found over 60 witnesses. And, you know, they tried to tabloidize the story, and I was the guy who gave the Enquirer reporter Marcel's contact information because the first book, The Roswell Incident, had been finished. It was going to be published. And so, you know, they distorted it totally, made it sound like I get my information from the tabloids. And that same nonsense has been picked up. I just read a complaint the other day. A guy emailed me a really nasty piece on the Skeptoid. I don't know who that is, but UFO wacko, obsessed with UFOs, that's Stanton Friedman. Didn't say scientist or anything like that. And they got the whole sequence wrong about who did what, where, when, who went into town, and so forth. And it matters, because when you get the story wrong, it doesn't make any sense. When you get it right, it does make sense. So
what would you like to tell those skeptics out there?
Well, you know, I like to take them on, and I used to take on Philip Klass, who was the noisiest negativist of them all, worked senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology. And mm-hmm. We had many close encounters, if you will. Mm-hmm. But it's aggravating to me when they bring in the skeptics who don't know anything and let them get away with bloody murder. Mm-hmm. It's not good journalism. As a matter of fact, one of the 12 PhD theses that there have been was about the press coverage and had scathing comments about the inadequacy of the press coverage, failure to go for the right people and stuff like that. And so that's one of the things that I write a monthly column for the MUFON Journal and UFO Magazine. And lately, a lot of my columns have been to attack the noisy negativists and the stupid things that they get away with saying in public. Mm-hmm. And somebody's got to. It's one of those nasty jobs. Somebody's got to do it. And
go ahead and share what your views about UFOs, as many of the major things that you can come up with about what is going on. What is a
UFO?
Well,
okay, it's clear that the planet's being visited by a lot of, I'll call them motherships, huge monster ships. The story in that thing in Texas was a mile long, half mile wide. Well, there's a case up in the Yukon, northwestern Canada, not quite into Alaska. Martin Jasek, a civil engineer, found 31 different people, this was 1996, December, who had, in groups of two or three, had seen this huge thing tooling around in the sky up there. In a not very heavily populated area. I've been up there and stopped at the place where he found many of these people, the owner of the gas station restaurant. You know, there aren't a lot of them up there. Mm-hmm. And especially in the winter, you know, there are not a lot of places to stop, so most of the people had stopped there, and he was able to get back and find out who had seen what. Anyway, he was able to triangulate. The front end was over the mountain, the back end was over the lake, that sort of thing. Came up with a size of half a mile to 1.2 miles long. So I call that the mothership, if you will. Mm-hmm. And think of a huge aircraft carrier carrying 75 little airplanes on it. Nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that the United States has can run for 18 years without refueling. The little airplanes that they carry, which are, don't run on the water, run in the sky, can't fly more than a few hours without refueling. So that's the first thing. We have every indication there are these huge motherships which have lots of what I call Earth excursion modules that run around in the atmosphere. These are the ones that land. Ted Phillips in Missouri has collected more than 4,000 physical trace cases from over 80 countries now. Cases where the saucer is seen on or near the ground, and after it leaves, one finds physical changes. These are not crop circles now. Mm-hmm. These are the equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks, and about a sixth of those cases involve reports of beings, creatures, humanoids, you know, I don't care what you call them. They're not going to give me a hard time, I don't think.
Well, give us an example of what kind of beings they are.
Well, in Ted's cases, they're almost all short guys with big heads, call them grays if you want. People see these, they're out in the back 40, and this thing comes down, and holy cow, look at that. Sometimes you see them through windows. Most of the time, the beings are out of the craft picking up specimens, samples, whatever you want to call it. They're checking things out. You know, a bunch of graduate students doing their thesis research on what's going on down here.
Do you think
they're from
Zeta Reticuli? Is that...
Well, I think some of them are. I mean, that's one of the features in the book Captured. Now, remember that my co-author who did most of the work is Kathleen Martin, Betty's niece. The full title is Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And Kathleen had all her tapes, all the hypnosis tapes. And an important thing there, you know, at the time when I first heard about this, it sort of bugged me. Why didn't Dr. Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist who did the hypnosis in separate sessions with Betty and Barney over a six-month period, every week now? So we're not talking about a quick visit. Oh, I know what happened to you. Dr. Simon was a world-class expert at getting people to work through what I would call post-traumatic stress syndrome. At the time, they called it shell shock war veterans from World War II, and there were lots of them. Dr. Simon actually ran a 3,000-bed hospital for shell shock war veterans, mm-hmm. and he had a higher success rate than anybody else. So,
Back in 1961, wouldn't you say he wouldn't have a clue as to what UFOs were?
he didn't care about them. That wasn't his concern. And as a matter of fact, one of the important things that Kathy did in the book, she had all the tapes. And most people had read The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller, but they didn't realize that Simon had asked some of the same questions several different times from a different viewpoint. Now, Kathleen transcribed all the tapes. And one thing that was clear is that Dr. Simon, rather than encouraging them to think that they had been abducted by aliens, tried to get Barney to believe that he was just picking up on Betty's dreams. She had several dreams a few weeks after this event, and she'd kept notes. So one of the things Kathleen did was to see what did Betty say she dreamt, and then what did Barney describe in those situations. And they don't match. He did not. You know, the usual complaint from the noisy negativist is that, oh, the hypnotist just put words in the mouth of the supposed abductee. Didn't really happen. They have a notion, and they, you know, it's the same with sexual abuse of children. You know, it's the psychologist that we blame for that. He's just putting words, and it didn't really happen. Well, in this case, we got the opposite situation. It's very clear that Dr. Simon was moving him away from the notion of an alien abduction.
I remember in the book reading how Barney was very frustrated with Dr. Simon.
Yeah, he was, and for good reason, because Simon kept pushing him in that direction, and he wouldn't go there because that's not what happened. And so the book, rather than being biased pro alien abduction, it shows that the psychiatrist who did the work was biased in the other direction.
And well, I thought it was very well done, and proving within numerous factual things, such as the blue dress with the pink stain or whatever.
Yeah, there were a lot of little details, and I hadn't realized until Kathy and I were signing books at the last MUFON convention in August in Denver, and an awful lot of people told us that, you know, it was that story that got them interested in UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Either the book, The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller, or the two Look magazine articles, or the television program with James Earl Jones playing Barney. And
why don't you describe it? This was like one of the first. This is the prototype.
Well, yeah, it's
abductions. And here's a couple, a mixed black and white couple. They, you know, definitely were not your norm of the time.
No, not in New Hampshire in 1971, that's for sure.
It's incredible. Why don't you describe what happened?
Well, okay, it was a second marriage for each, and they had taken a quick sort of a second honeymoon up to Canada, and they went to Niagara Falls and came around past Montreal, and they were going to stay, and then the weather report indicated there was a hurricane coming up the Atlantic coast. They lived in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is in that little bit of New Hampshire between Maine and Massachusetts that's on the coast. Most of New Hampshire is not on the coast, but Portsmouth is. It's a naval base. It was an Air Force base at that time, a big one. And so they decided that they'd go home because they wanted to beat that hurricane. So they're driving in the roads of New Hampshire late at night, September 19th, 1961, and they spot this, Betty spots first and tells Barney she's watching a flying saucer, and he laughs and figures it's just a Piper Cub. And then she, it can't be. Look how it's moving. Well, maybe it's a helicopter, Betty. There aren't any flying saucers. They had binoculars. She watched with them, and they're driving south. There's nobody around. I mean, this is after midnight in New Hampshire in September. It's not, you know, joyous time of heavy traffic, to say the least. And they stopped twice to look at this thing because it was sort of following them above the hills. They were down in the valley. And it was behaving, the flight pattern, a stair-step kind of pattern. And it was just peculiar. And they stopped, and Barney looking with the binoculars and scared the heck out of him because he could see a double row of windows where this thing had stopped, and beings inside staring back at him, and he suddenly got very frightened. I mean, he had a gun with him. Black man, you know, they had a dog, they would go out, they were worried about bears, but they were also worried about people, too. And got very frightened, dashed back to the car. Suddenly, there's some strange sounds in the trunk, and they see a sign that says Concord, New Hampshire, like 35 miles, and it had been 50 miles. You know, something was wrong here. Anyway, they drive on home. They got home 2 hours later than they should have gotten home. Their both watches had stopped. Barney's shoes were scuffed, which was very unusual for Barney. He was very well dressed. I should add that I met Betty many times. I met Betty and Barney. We had dinner together way back in 1968. He died just a few months later. And I've been in Betty's house since. And I was the first to look into the star map work scientifically, at least to publish about it.
Yeah, that's another really big piece. But go ahead and finish the story.
Okay, so they get home. There are a number of puzzles. They look at their car. There's some spots on there. And Betty called her sister, Kathleen's mother. This is the next day. And she talked to somebody who suggested putting a compass near it, and for some crazy reason, the compass went wild when it was near these spots about the size of, a silver dollar on the car. We still don't know why, but it was very peculiar. Anyway, Betty had these dreams a while later. I mean, they're trying to make sense out of this. Betty read a book.
Wasn't her zipper broken, too? And,
well, yeah. The,
you know,
the
she was
dress,
pretty disheveled.
The dress she never wore it again. She put it in the closet. The zipper was broken, the lining was torn a bit, and it was just sitting there. And we still have no clue that there were any aliens involved or anything like that. There was a missing time part of the experience. And she wrote NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, after getting a book out of the library, which gave an address to write to. And they were interrogated by Walter Webb, a NICAP investigator, a month later or so. Spent 6 hours with him. And he did notice that the time, you know, why did it take you so long to get from Montreal to Portsmouth? Because there was no traffic, So eventually, Betty had these dreams. Barney developed an ulcer that got so bad he couldn't work.
Post-traumatic syndrome, yeah.
Yeah, well, doctor says, I can't do anything more for you, Barney. I think you ought to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist then referred him to Dr. Simon, because he felt something was wrong here. Barney had to get back to work. And their trouble seemed to date back to the time of this incident. And so Dr. Simon then conducts these separate sessions, induces amnesia at the end of each session, tapes them all. And it was in these sessions that he discovered the terror on their part as they relived the part of the experience that dealt with the aliens taking them on board, examining them, tossing them back out. Now, it's not that the aliens did anything terrible to them, not the way we treat animals, but the situation, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. You know, are we ever going to go back? They had kids from previous marriages? What's going on here? And so I have it in writing, and Kathy mentions it in the book, that Dr. Simon at one point says that the emotional terror, when he had them under hypnosis separately now, the other one not in the room, not being able to hear, was greater than that of any of the shell shock war veterans he had treated. Mm-hmm. That's pretty strong coming from Dr. Simon, because he literally had worked with thousands. And there's actually an Army movie, Let There Be Light, that Kathy has a copy of that I've seen, in which they show how he helped so many of these veterans get back to normal. So to say that their terror was as great as that of anybody they had dealt with is a pretty strong statement. And the aliens seem to be curious as much as anything else. And we can learn a lot about their behavior. That is, they didn't seem to be intending to hurt. And I love the scene where they come in and start pulling on. They're in separate rooms now. And the people who were with Barney came into Betty's room and start pulling on her teeth. And she asked the leader, the only one who seemed to be able to talk English, what are they doing? What's happening here? And he tells her that they don't understand why Barney's teeth come out and hers don't. You know, one of those little bits and pieces. Uh-huh. Also, Betty was demanding that she wanted to have something to prove that this experience had happened, because otherwise people wouldn't believe her. And they let her pick up what I'll call a book. You know, I don't know who the publisher was, but and they let her hold on to it, and then just before they were put back out, when the examinations were finished, they took the book away, and Betty's screaming at them, "That's my proof! We have decided that you won't remember." There's a bit of democracy in there, you know? It wasn't just one. There were 11 beings on board, incidentally, and weren't identical, and they were all short guys. Yeah, no question. And so we get glimpses of this thing. Also, Betty, you have to understand, Barney's grandfather was a slave. Betty's family grew up in New Hampshire going back to like 1640. So she knew who she was. Her mother lived and died in the same, was born in the same house in which she died, you know, 80 years later. So Betty could face up to anybody, is what I'm saying. She was a social worker, important point here.
She's a pretty gutsy lady, I remember.
Yeah, she was. And she was a short lady, 5 foot tall, you know, and it reminds me of my late mother-in-law, who her father had told her when she got married to her husband that she's not very strong, you know. Well, that was when she was 19. She died at 95, had given birth to 9 kids. crack of 26 grandchildren and 41 great-grandchildren.
This is your grandmother?
No, my mother-in-law, late mother-in-law. And the point is, she was a short, a slight person, 5 foot tall maybe, and Betty was like that. But
yeah.
Betty was feisty when she wanted to be, and as a social worker, she was a supervisor in the welfare department, state of New Hampshire. And, you know, one of the many myths is that they sought attention. They tried to prevent a reporter who had gotten a tape from somebody who had heard them speak.
Yeah, they didn't want any attention.
No, and they thought they were going to lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they were very worried. They went to a lawyer. There's nothing you can do. And so they were shocked when the story came out in the Boston paper that they got nice response from all over the world. But I'll tell you something. Dr. Simon was very worried. The way they worked it out with John Fuller doing the book is that Simon would have final say on anything in the book. And I have visited the archives at Boston University where the writer, John Fuller's papers are, and I've seen Simon's comments. And boy, he gave Fuller a hard time. I mean, I'm working on a book, and that's tough enough. I wouldn't want somebody looking over my shoulder saying, no, you can't say that. Of course you can't say that. And that would make me look stupid. And I guess it's a better book for it. But
well, it's interesting. Again, this is the first abduction story. And when it hit the headlines, it really, wow, it took the...
Yeah.
They made a movie and everything out of it.
Yeah, and it was... there's a bit of irony. I was called by Universal Studios to see if I could help when they were making the movie, UFO incident, 1975, NBC. I was living in Southern California. I found out that they'd gotten my name from the Air Force, which I thought was very funny, and I was glad, because it happened, and they didn't know it when they called me, that I had met Betty and Barney. I had published about the star map work. I had, you know, helped explain the star map work at a meeting of the Mutual UFO Network when Marjorie Fish, the brilliant woman who did all the work, almost all of it, and so they happened to pick the right guy, but I don't think they intended to help out the situation.
Well, it's amazing. We only have now a few minutes left. I will tell people to call if they are wanting to ask a question. I'm hoping that we're covering all the questions that they would want to ask. But at any rate, there are 800 numbers to call on the Internet. And it's interesting now, that map, how interesting that Betty had the gumption to ask the leader,
That's right.
You know, where are you from? And
I know you're not from around here, she said.
I mean, that she would even have the wherewithal to talk to these.
Part of that was that they had stuck a big needle in her navel, and she screamed, and they didn't expect it to hurt, and so the leader, the guy with the needle, waved his hand, and the pain went way down. So she was grateful for that. Mm-hmm. But the examination was over, thank goodness. So here she is, and Barney's still in the other room, and she has the guts to ask, you know, where are you from? I know you're not from around here. He shows her this three-dimensional map, probably a hologram, except we didn't have the word back then, so we didn't know what they were. And it was a crazy conversation. And she says, well, where are you on the map? It's three-dimensional, 2 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet. And he asks her, well, do you know where you are on the map? Now, I don't know anything about astronomer. He's told her that there are stars, these points of light. They're connected with different kinds of lines, heavy trade routes, light trade routes, occasional expeditions. And, you know, I don't know anything about astronomy, she tells him. And he says, well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. I mean, you know, it's another one of these little bits that it wasn't that he wasn't willing to share some information,
mm-hmm.
But, you know, what's the point of talking to somebody who isn't going to know what it means anyway? And
but
obviously,
it is amazing that she could recall, and I know it was under hypnosis. And
it was a post-hypnotically recalled map that she drew with the instruction, only if she could remember it accurately. It turns out, I asked about this, and Betty has a really good three-dimensional sense, better than mine, I think. And I will say, Phil Klass, in a debate we had, took a sheet of paper, put a bunch of dots on it, and handed it to me, and I want you to draw that later on. And I pointed out, Phil, my name is not Betty Hill. You know, she was instructed with nobody else around except Dr. Simon, and to remember it all accurately and all the rest of that. Here I am on a stage with an auditorium full of people without lines on this map that Phil handed me, just dots. You know, it was one of these...
Well, he was just, you know, ridiculous.
Yeah, well, that's typical Phil.
Yeah.
And,
so basically, the map indicated, or at least some authorities believe, that it's the Zeta Reticuli...
Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. Mm-hmm. That's the constellation of Reticulum, which is the net. And you can't see it from here. You got to go down the equator or below. And what it did was highlight the fact, not known before, Marjorie Fish did her work. She built 26 different three-dimensional models, beads on nylon line. Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli just happened to be, not known beforehand, the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire neighborhood. Now, stars vary much more than people do. There are big ones and small ones and old ones and new ones and hot ones and cold ones, some whose output of energy varies with time. You know, freeze and boil.
Mm-hmm.
But these two stars, they're just down the street. That's the first thing. Not another galaxy, just 39 light years away. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is 100,000 light years across, so it's local neighborhood. And those two stars are only an eighth of a light year apart from each other, which means, to put it in perspective, 35 times closer to each other than our star, the Sun, is to the next star over. And they just happen to be a cool billion years older than the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had plenty of time to develop new technology, better technology. They'd have far more incentive to go traipsing around the neighborhood when they know they can see the planets around the other star. From a planet around one, looking over at the other, you can see it all day long.
Mm-hmm.
So a very different situation, and it makes sense, but in retrospect, we didn't know about this special characteristic. The kicker here is it's hard to measure distances to stars from the surface of the Earth. And the interesting thing is that Marjorie Fish's work building these models, and she found only one pattern that matched, that the work has stood the test of time, because now we have millions of measurements that were made by
the...
Well,
it's amazing what she had to go through without any computer help. It was just
no,
amazing.
All hand. She had a hand copy the distances to these stars and the angles, and then build models to match that. And she redid this a lot of times because the data was so variable. Back then, if you say in the late 60s, if you looked up five star catalogs for stars, say, 20, 30, 40 light years away, you get five different numbers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to get a match in the real world to a three-dimensional, you know, where the stars are, you need the distance data.
Well, there's so many pieces to the puzzle that came together when I read the book, and I highly recommend people check it out and read it and really get the full impact of this first abduction. It really is historic, and
it's on my website, incidentally.
I was just going to say, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, you can get it from Amazon, and you can get it from Barnes & Noble and all over the place, and it's on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and the big advantage from the website is you'll get a copy of the book that's signed by both Kathleen Marden and myself.
Nice. really.
And so my other books are there, too, of course, Top Secret Magic and Crash at Corona. And there's.
And I had so many questions I wanted to ask them, because I'm going to have you back, Stan. This is incredible.
I'll still be around.
But the last question is, do you believe these aliens are still coming here, and were they the ones that made the pact with the Eisenhower administration? And
I don't know. That's a story that I haven't been able to verify. I've had two people tell me they saw the footage of the craft land at Holloman Air Force Base, and we have the story of Ike meeting with somebody over at Edwards Air Force Base. And that's part of the mystery here. The government isn't telling us what it knows. So there's a new book out, Shoot Them Down, telling about there were orders given to shoot down UFOs if they didn't land when instructed to do so back in 1952.
Yeah.
And when you check the
record,
you
find
200 planes crashed that year. I've had 7 stories of planes going up and not coming back. So there's a whole secret.
Well, many believe
world.
That Star Wars weapons have been created just for that reason, to keep.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me at all, because especially when Ron Reagan said, 5 different times he said, if there were an external threat, we would work together. And he had a sighting himself, incidentally, and I talked to his pilot, so I know it happened. That pilot had 30,000 hours, which is an enormous amount of time. He'd been an instructor. But Reagan said, if there was an external threat, we would all work together on this planet. And the kicker is that Star Wars, Reagan said, after talking about the evil empire, remember he said we were going to share the technology with the Russians?
Mm.
That seems a real contrasting viewpoint. They're an evil empire, and you're going to share this most advanced technology, Star Wars kind of thing.
Well, we'll have to pick up on this subject in the potential concern of a staged invasion, ET invasion, that the shadow government may be planning and so forth. So there's just so much to cover, Stan, and it's been
a big story.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. I want people to know that you've been listening to Stan Friedman on Carrie L's HeartLink radio show. And please do tune in again in 2 weeks. We'll have Dr. Brooks Agnew. He has written a book also, and that's The Arc of Millions of Years. So I'm looking forward to that. So thank you, Stan. And
my pleasure.
Do go to Stan's website and mine as well, the HeartLinkInstitute.com, and that will have a link to Stan's website.
Good.
And good evening, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.